Impro Mafia presents And Time!
Ladies and gentlemen, welcome one, welcome all to And Time, a podcast for improvisers and aspiring improvisers, hosted by the magnificent, the marvelous, the mellifluous Daniel Beeston.
That's me.
And also along for the ride is me, Natalie Bohensky. Good evening, Dan. How are you this evening?
I'm very well.
And we should note this is our first test podcast, so if anybody is listening, beware, mistakes are likely. So please bear with us as we get the hang of this new spooky podcasting software.
If anyone is listening, I'd like to know where they got the tapes from.
There'll be a public inquiry held in every city in Australia to find out the culprit. So, Dan, over to you. Recent impro events in Brisbane, what's been happening?
Well, last weekend, obviously, we had our graduation show for our little rookies.
We did. Now, I like to use the term beginners.
I like to use the term loser improvisers who don't yet know how to do impro properly.
Now
the very
harsh.
Bottom tier of the talent structure.
Well, when I first started doing impro, beginners were always referred to as rookies. And to me, it became almost a pejorative term. It became, oh, you're just a rookie. You're just simply a rookie. So for me, it has a kind of weird negative connotation. So I like to think about new workshoppers as beginners.
I can see how you could have the negative connotations, but being that I'm no longer one of them, I don't really care.
Okay.
I think it's important to put them in their place.
So you're happy to now be at the top echelon.
Yes. Now I can look down on those rookies and the greenness.
You've put yourself at the top, Dan. Have you put yourself there or somebody else anointed you?
No, I put myself
there.
No one else would do that lifting for
me. No one else would do that. Well, so beginners, rookies, whatever the term is, they're people who are new to impro. And Impro Mafia has just begun in the last couple of months its own workshop program, being taught by the maestro, Wade Robinson, and helped in some small part by me when I wasn't working, going along to help Wade with the teaching. And I have to say, it was such a positive experience. And our workshoppers, there was a group of about 10, had a really, really good time, and they seemed to all really enjoy the classes. They seemed relaxed. They seemed happy to take part.
A lot of very talented people in there too.
Absolutely.
You don't tend to see a rookie class who are so adept at just sort of jumping in.
Well, it was really good to see, and it's important when you're starting out at impro, it can be really intimidating, especially even in a class situation where you know all the other participants of the workshop, it can still be intimidating to get up there and to put your ideas out and to try to think up things on the spot and to hope that you're going to be good at it and hope that you've got some skill. But these guys just jumped in feet first and sort of relished the challenge of it, which was great to see the enthusiasm. And the graduation show, Dan played yourself. I was there as a judge, and I honestly, it was a really, really good show for the beginner level. I didn't think that these guys would bomb out because I thought they had a great sort of talent to begin with, but I didn't think they would do as well as they did. Dan, you were on stage playing with them. What was it like?
I loved it. I always love playing with rookies because they tend to throw you curveballs all the time. I find that playing well is something that people start doing. And the more you play, the better you do at not playing poorly. So the people were doing great things up there, but because they're new, they're also making tragic mistakes. And I always enjoy being mixed up in that. When you're working with people who you've been working with for a decade, you know what to expect.
To some degree.
Well, to most degrees these days.
You can expect that if you come on stage as Hitler, they might come on stage as Roosevelt, or they'll come on stage as appropriate opposing character or an appropriate supporting character. Whereas I guess maybe what you're saying with the beginners is you don't have that guarantee.
Yes. And it's always fascinating to see them, the ones who want to be funny as opposed to the ones who want to do improv, because someone will say something and they're trying to make a joke and we've sort of been doing it long enough not to do that.
So that's an important lesson, I guess, if there are any beginner improvisers, and even for the people who've been doing it for ages, because we all have those moments where we think, if I was to say X right now, it would be so funny. Not necessarily so.
It's always a playoff of how funny the line would be and how poorly the scene is already going and whether you can risk wrecking it. Because if it's a really average scene, you're like, oh, maybe I can just, whip out a dumb joke and then pull the ripcord and whoosh, I'm out of there.
Well, that's true. It could be a what we call a tag, so you're ending the scene on a positive note. And in those situations, it can be good because you can give the audience who may have been thinking, this doesn't seem to be going so well, as you say, give them the parachute. Bang, here's the joke. Let's all move off stage. The audience remembers the funniness of the last joke. But that's a really good point to remember that you shouldn't break it out. If a scene's going well and if everybody's enjoying the scene and the audience is engaged, don't wreck it with a one-off gag, because...
And you want to hope it's funny.
Well, exactly right. You don't want this reaction.
You don't want to ruin...
Oh.
Boo, you stuck.
You don't want that reaction. So I guess out of the beginner's show, what can we say? Really good enthusiasm. Fun to participate in. Yeah, I think it was really fun and it was fun to play in. And then we backed up the next night to after the Saturday graduation show for the beginners. We backed up on the Sunday night for Extreme Impro, which you,
yes.
Daniel Beeston, missed.
I did.
Some excuse, like it was your wife's birthday. I mean, come on.
Actually, I heard that there was going to be nudity involved, and I've seen Wade dressed only in a towel already, and I didn't want my eyes opened anymore.
Oh, come on. You were looking forward to getting down to your jocks. Deny it.
Well, I'm naked right now.
It's nude podcasting. It was the nudity in question, if you are listening to this, was Tom Dunstan, the MC, wanted to have this theme of extreme impro to not only have the team members really knocking heads, clashing heads and really trying to trash talk each other and push out a sort of a rock and roll wrestling feel, but also to have the players pushed to their skill level and have their playing experiences pushed out, so to take more risks, to be more adventurous. And the culmination of that was the first scene back from the interval, which was strip questions, which meant that everyone on stage had to speak in questions, and if you didn't, you had to remove an item of clothing. So because we'd been pre-warned of this, we were able to go up to the Arts Theatre's brilliant costume department and purloin 5 pairs of stripper pants, velcroed and stud hooked stripper pants, which were left over from a production of The Full Monty that they did some years ago. So at halftime, we all got changed for those who could fit into the pants. We all got changed into. Well, they're quite restrictive, and particularly for me, because male pants don't really fit, you know, my womanly curves, as it were. So I was sort of squeezed into the smallest pair, and then some people's pairs were too big and they kept falling down. Mm. Others were too small. Others
so too tight at the sides for you.
Too tight.
Too loose at the front is what you get.
Yeah. Potentially. So I don't want to give anything away, crying game style. But so we all got it, and we had also found some boxer shorts up in the costume department as well, which were red boxer shorts with stud written on them. So when it came time to getting on stage, Greg and Tristan were first. Tristan took off his shoes and socks first, and then Greg ripped off his... I think he ripped off the pants first, or maybe it was his shirt. But anyway, so they were these stripper pants. You grab them around the top of the waist, rip, tear goes the Velcro, and off comes the pants. And it was very well received. I was wearing 3 shirts.
Well, that's cheating.
And I knew that I would not be able to really have my brain in action. Well, do you know those girls who read the naked news on the internet?
I have never been exposed to this, nor would I watch it were I to discover the URL.
Well, let me enlighten you. There is various services now on the internet where you can see women reading the news, beautifully delivered, but also removing their clothing as they do it. I'm a journalist and I actually read the news for a living. I have tremendous respect for these ladies because it's very difficult just to sit and concentrate on delivering your scripts and your news when you're reading the news, to actually be doing something else, like removing your clothing and doing it and timing it all beautifully. I think they have a skill that's vastly underappreciated. So when I was on stage and trying to take part in the scene, which is a difficult enough scene as it is, trying to always talk in questions, and then having the added pressure of making sure I was able to remove clothes without losing too much dignity, it really became quite a challenge. And I, of course, got stuck. I had a massive brain freeze or my brain turned into sludge, whichever way you choose, and I didn't know what to do. I just remember thinking at a certain point, I can't take off any more clothes. I'd gotten down to a pair of boxers and a singlet, and I was like, I can't remove my shorts because they'll see my thighs, and I can't remove my shirt because they'll see my belly, and I don't want them to see either of those things.
I always find the problem with those games with the handles where you're disrobing or having to eat marshmallows and stuff like that is that you're never thinking about the story when it's happening. It's they turn into real hoop games.
And yeah.
Because you want to say statements. You're sitting there going, well, for the value of the scene, I want to take off clothes because that'll be interesting for the audience. But you want to say statements in a way that makes you look like you didn't intend to say a statement and that you've made a mistake.
Are you reading too much into it, though? For such a game as this, you're nervous enough already. I think you have to accept that the story element of the game is really going to be the least important priority. When you know it's such an obvious hoop game, when you know that removing clothes is what the audience wants.
Like they want to see you fail in order to remove clothes. They want to see you punished. But if you're doing it on purpose, then they can see you're taking charge.
But for me, I was failing not because I wanted to. I was failing because I was so nervous about taking clothes off, I couldn't think of any questions to say.
That's what you want to do.
So I was so nervous that it had the unintended effect of, I guess, making me... I didn't think it made me play better, but it certainly made me forced me to take my clothes off, even as I got more and more nervous about taking my clothes off. So I think that the Extreme Impro night as a whole, it was quite heavy on hoop games. There were a lot of handles. The way Tom had structured it, he had us all betting against each other. He had two audience members betting on the teams on behalf, kind of like a poker style. You've got this many points you can bet with. So and then if you decided the teams could double down, so then they got a handle if they wanted to get extra points. So it was quite a hoopy night. So I think when you've got nights like that, you have to just kind of enjoy those games and take those games for what they are, which are audience crowd pleasers, you know, live up to the promise of the hoop, be it taking your clothes off, be it speaking, you know, singing every line, whatever it was. Enjoy them, relish them, and make that the theme of the night. So, and hopefully you'll get some chances to do story games in the middle, or you'll get the next Impro Show a chance to do more story games.
Now, I got the impression from Tom's email that it wasn't just about stripping off, but about exposing more of yourself emotionally and such. Were there games in there which are, like, was there any truth type games? Was there anything that really challenged you?
No, well, there was a kiss. The first game was Kiss in a Minute, which began with Greg and Wade snogging for about 20 seconds.
Ah, well, man on man love, that's not really...
That's always a favourite.
Oh, well, yes. The audience loves to hear about it afterwards.
Look, probably not as much as we were expecting, mainly because there were a lot of the hoops on top of that, and so it did make it probably more difficult to get to more of an emotional truth night. It became more extreme in terms of the hurdles that you had to perform as an improviser, that sense of extreme, as opposed to raw emotional extreme. I think it could be done that way. Maybe Tom, I think, will have a look at how many handles he put on things and, you know, what's the best number of hoop games to put in a show, how do you space them out to ensure that the audience likes them but doesn't get sick of them, so, and that the players are able to vary their styles and, you know, do the performing monkey games and then do some less hoopy, gaggy ones. But all in all, it was well received. Our crowd was a bit down, but we were expecting that because it was very wet, and also there was the Australia v Iraq World Cup qualifying game at Suncorp Stadium, which is of course just behind the theatre. Hopefully next year we'll be able to sit down and look at a sports schedule, find out when the big games are for Suncorp Stadium.
For this weekend, when the public holidays are, because if we had it in 2 days rather than last Sunday,
well,
then
keep in mind we do have a grudge match comedy football show.
That's true.
On at the Stage Door Dinner Theatre this coming
Sunday. I can drink responsibly after
you
that.
You can drink responsibly. The next day is a public holiday. Not for me. I'll be working. I don't get public holidays off. Everyone else. I know. I suffer for my art. But yeah, it is a good thing to remember that this Sunday is grudge match comedy football. And I guess with the promotion of that show, that kind of winds up our week in impro.
Well, let's move on to news.
News.
I wonder if I should put
news.
Some music.
News with Dan Beeston.
All right. Well, what's been going on recently? I found this that I'm quite excited about. because I'd like to... I expect that we'll get this sort of offer from the audience, is the Phoenix Lander.
Oh, yes.
The new NASA device that they've lobbed down onto Mars. This one's been one that sort of had rocket boosters, so it just sort of gently touched down on the planet like a dandelion seed.
At 5 miles an hour.
Yeah, which I think that's a bit soft. I like the last one that they basically fired at the planet and bounced for about 40K before finally coming to a stop.
A man's lander.
Yes. Or the Beagle.
That just disappeared completely.
The Beagle, if I remember correctly, the Beagle was a joint project between the US and the UK. And somewhere along the line, someone forgot to translate metres to yards.
Oh.
And so they aimed for the parachute to deploy 100 metres above the ground. And in fact, or 100 yards above the ground. And in fact, the parachute deployed about 500 metres under the ground. So it just they just kind of fired it into the surface. And then I like to think that the parachute popped out like a Bugs Bunny to the team.
Even though there's no atmosphere. Is there atmosphere? Not like it.
There's some atmosphere. There's a bit of carbon. But it's there's... No, there's wind.
Yeah.
Yeah. But they've recorded the wind.
Cool Bugs Bunny parachute effect.
Yeah.
Maybe.
You'd need Andy Graff. Possibly.
And that's a good one because things like space and, we do get it in impro later on the moon a lot in space. On a spaceship above the Earth, things like that. So, yes, possibly, on Mars could be a good offer, and that's a way you could bring in the Phoenix lander or, at NASA headquarters and you could be discussing the landing. We also had the Discovery take off this week, the Space Shuttle Discovery, and what I think is a great offer for Impro is the fact that it's going up to the International Space Station to repair its toilet.
It's a toilet.
I mean, wouldn't that just be a great Impro scene, like on the International Space Station with the malfunctioning toilet? The possibilities there of, fights between the Russian and the American astronauts and, who left the seat? Who did this?
It's
thanks to you, Yuri. We're having to poop out the out of sight hole.
It what says there's someone in there, but I know it's vacant.
There's only
let me into the toilet. I'm sorry, Dave.
I can't allow you to do number twos, Dave. I can't allow you to do that.
Yeah, I think that's enough on that subject before we end up wallowing.
Well, the big news this week in pop culture, I guess you'd say, is the release of the Sex and the City movie, which I took in yesterday morning at the Flicks. Oh, come now. Women do make up half of our audience, and I think Impro has a tendency and a justified reputation of being a little bit of a boys' club at times.
Oh, yeah.
So I think learning a bit more about things that a lot of women tend to enjoy would not do us a disservice at all. So what do you know about Sex and the City?
I have watched some episodes of the softcore pornography that is Sex and the City.
Ah, oh, dear.
And the hardcore shopping pornography.
I think, what's a recent show that I've seen that would have similar levels of sex in it and similar depictions? Certainly other of the HBO sort of dramas would have that level. I think it's just the frankness with which Sex and the City discusses sex and depicts sex, the way sometimes the mystery is taken out of it and it becomes very practical, it becomes a little bit too in your face, and it becomes a little bit too messy for a lot of people. And for some reason that seems to turn blokes off more than women, whereas women seem to quite enjoy a much more frank depiction of sex and all of the kind of the I don't mean to use this word pejoratively, but the bad things in inverted commas that can come with it, as well as the good things. Whereas with blokes, having women sort of going, oh look, there's someone having sex, there's someone having anal sex, there's someone talking about oral sex, there's someone talking about ejaculation, those sorts of things really seem to...
I'm going to have to bleep some of them.
Yeah. It's not... The radio station I work at, I heard one of the announcers say, this is his summation of Sex and the City was, isn't it just four bitches talking about things you shouldn't talk about? And I just thought that totally, for me, encaptured the kind of middle-class, white, male, 50-plus view of this show, which is... You shouldn't be able to talk about that. You shouldn't be able to talk about a woman's experience of sex. It should be a male's experience of sex or a woman's kind of romantic experience of sex in terms of a bit of kissing and then the lights go off and a lot of nice moaning. That's okay, but anything more real and more gritty is frightening to men. And the thing is that the show overall, in my opinion, is just good because it's really cleverly written. It's got witty lines, it's got great plot lines, it's got nice ways that the plots come together. Dan's eyes, people, if you're listening, are glazing over as I say this.
No, I'm probably misrepresenting my feelings on the show. I haven't watched it in a decade almost.
And this is the thing, I think you'd need to sit down and watch a good few episodes, and I think that you could get, pardon the pun, sucked in as much as as much as you
can. We go back to the toilet?
Look, for example, I really like Battlestar Galactica and I really like Doctor Who, and these are shows that would be considered more geeky or more boyish, and yet I really like them, and I find I sat down and watched Battlestar Galactica and got really, really hooked on it because it's well written, it's got nice characters, and it's fun to watch. And I think Sex and the City is the same. And if men just kind of looked past a lot of the upfront sex stuff and got past that and got over that emotional hurdle of, oh god, then you'd actually see quite a witty show with really tragically flawed characters and the way they deal with their flaws.
Actually, I quite liked the discussions that they had on the show.
Mm.
The discussions about sexual behaviour, and I'm always fascinated in how men and women relate to each other and how that's perceived, but I don't think I find the characters very likeable. I tend to be sold on a TV show based on whether I bond with any of the characters, and that's possibly because they're being written for a different demographic.
Yeah, but I'm interested to know why or what aspects of the characters that you don't like. Is it because of their sexual freedom?
It's not that there are aspects I don't like. It's just that there's nothing there that I do like.
Yeah.
There's like even with, for instance, I was quite keen on Friends when it was in its first run. Generally, I only really watched it because I liked Matthew Perry, and there was something about the Chandler character that I was really keen on. And, you know, anything that was too Joey heavy, you're like, blah.
Could you be any more predictable? I guess so. Friends had the whole likeable characters things down too. And I just remember when I first watched Friends, and someone would say something about how they had to pee. And where all the sitcoms of my youth that I used to watch, things like Full House, you know, you never mentioned the toilet, you never mentioned kind of human behaviour. It was never a life that I had. Now, Sex and the City is not by any means a life that I have. I'm as far removed from Manolo Blahnik and multiple sexual partners as you can probably get. But that's
you left your dildo here last week.
That's the element of fantasy to the show. I think you read a lot of columns and blogs about Sex and the City and people saying, has it affected women? And I'll read these things and there'll generally be a lot of men replying saying, oh yeah, all these chicks think they're now, you know, Carrie or Samantha from Sex and the City and they think they're entitled to be a bitch to you. And you go, no, I'm pretty sure they're just a bitch. Do you know what I mean?
Or there's a reason that they're being a bitch
and
to you.
Yeah, exactly. I don't think that you can say a TV show has influenced a generation of women to be, because the thing is about the TV show, which men would know if they watched it, is all the characters are very different. And so while the show is about their various sexual encounters, they're all very different because one
of
them...
All right, well, who are they? Well, You've got Carrie.
She's
the narrator.
She's the narrator of the show. She's a sort of a romantic type. She still believes in a true love, you know, having a big love, a big all-consuming love, but is kind of thwarted along the way.
Now
Samantha, who is the...
Old whore? Is that...
And
is that
this is sort of what...
That might have been misrepresented
because,
to me.
Exactly, because if you have a man in his 40s... who has a lot of sexual partners, is a very successful business person with a great self-esteem, a great self-image, and a desire to have sex with multiple partners, then generally they're not frowned upon. And in TV, they're generally looked upon as someone kind of, hey, cool. Samantha is almost the Mr. Big of a female kind, you know what I mean?
Whereas so she's very sexually forward.
She's very sexually active. Sex for her is something extremely natural, extremely something that she finds extremely natural, and she has a great sexual appetite, but she is cautious and careful and upfront about how she views things. She doesn't go out of her way to make people fall in love with her. She doesn't go out of her way to fall in love with people. She doesn't want to involve messy emotions. She's just in it for the physical sensation, which she finds extremely natural to her. There are some people.
So
like
she's
that.
A man.
Well, this is the thing. These traits are considered masculine, and for a female to possess them seems to be like a letting down of the guardianship of morality that women are supposed to possess. You know, if women feel that they can be as sexually free and adventurous as they want to be, a whole societal structure will collapse because who will look after the babies and who will be, you know, faithful to the men. Do you know what I mean? It's behaviour that's acceptable more so in men than women, even in this day and age. If you had the similar show, well, it depends. I've heard some people say, which could be true, if you had a similar show starring all men, it would be lambasted as being sexist by, you know, feminist groups.
But it wouldn't be taken off.
Well, the thing is
it would be.
I think you've got a lot of shows already that have characters like that. Older men who have lots of lovers, and that's okay. James Bond, for example, is a great character.
It's not so much it's okay. They are generally seen to be flaws, but then I guess there seem to be flaws in Sex and the City as well.
Yeah,
not a lot of shows where it goes, wow, that guy's having sex with a different person each night. There's always that, like, for instance, if we go back to Joey from Friends, who's always it's always those episodes where he gets caught up in an emotional episode where you're like, oh, wow, he's growing, he's becoming a better person.
But still, I mean, and Joey, I'm sure, slept with as many different people as Samantha has in Sex and the City, but you never get the type of outrage, because Samantha is also an older woman. She's a woman that by society standards should have partnered and had children. By society standards, she's not. She's in her 40s. By the movie, she's in her late 40s. And while she, in the movie, is in a relationship, and so the movie is actually her journey of discovering monogamy, you know, how she deals with monogamy and how that's very unnatural for her. And then you've got Miranda, who's more the cynical type. She, you know, would like to believe in things like true love and fidelity, but has been let down, and she's also much more self-reliant. And her flaw is that she probably could do with being a little more trusting of people and a little bit more giving. And then you've got Charlotte, who's the sort of hopeless romantic, believes in a happy ever after, believes the best in everybody.
She's a bit naive too.
A bit naive in that in the series, she believed that she would marry her rich doctor husband and be happily ever after, and found that it wasn't necessarily the case, that wasn't the way for her, and that being rich and good looking didn't make you the perfect husband. And so the series ended with Charlotte marrying a bald, kind of plain looking lawyer, but realising that he very much loved her and that was what was more important, despite everything she did. Whatever she did, he would still love her and truly love her, and so that was the lesson that she learned.
So have you seen the film?
I saw it yesterday.
And
it's enjoyable.
Is it as good as the better episodes from the series?
Yeah, I think so. It has moments. For me, it's more about their journey as they're all partnered up. This is the ironic thing about outrage about Sex and the City, is the actual story of the movie is one of where they only really have one man each to deal with. It's not multiple sexual escapades at all. And for Samantha...
So it's your standard fare.
Yeah, it's really just
Grant
about...
Put Hugh Grant in there and could be a British...
Exactly. It's a romantic comedy about how you deal with life once you find, quote-unquote, the one, what happens next. And so that's good about it. Look, it's not perfect. It's got some minor flaws. Some of the storylines are kind of not equally as weighted as the others, and obviously Carrie's is the main one. And there are decisions that the characters make that you might not necessarily agree with, and certainly there were some which I went, oh. But there are also others where you go, yeah, no, that's fair enough, or I agree with that, or there's a point. The overall point of the film is that, you know, your friends matter, and if you have good friends around you to help you out when it counts, then that's the most important thing, no matter what stage of your love life.
And I think what you just said is the crux of why men are not interested in the film.
Yeah, I guess so. For me, Sex and the City always makes me feel kind of sad. I wish I had the same kind of bond with girlfriends that they do in the movie. I don't really have that with other girls. I have some good girlfriends, but I wouldn't say we get
together. They
don't
sleep around enough, possibly.
Well, no, it's just that kind of that real intimacy with friends. I've got some friends and we chat, but I don't have what I would call uber best girlfriends. I've always wanted them. I would still like them, but I'm not, for some reason, blessed with that. So,
if you'd like to be Natalie's friend, please email us.
Go to girlclumsy.com, fill out the application. That's just me. But then my character is that I all of my friends have always been sort of guys as well. I've tended to always like the company of men. Yeah, completely so. So I'm nude right now. Nude podcasting!
That's probably enough for Sex and the City talk. Why don't we move on to this week's subject, the old favourite improv game, Word at a Time Story.
Oh, Act 1, Scene 1, Word at a Time Story. It's a good one to kind of get across to the audience what you mean by improvised.
I've always been... I was always a bit worried about it, but Dave Massingham convinced me to put it at the beginning of every single show, and I haven't looked back.
Really?
Yep, if for no other reason that it's good to get you started, because if you're looking at a blank page when you're trying to script a show, then you're in trouble. But you write down a word at a time story, boom, you're off.
Okay. It is a good way of getting people used to the idea of what you mean by we make it all up on the spot.
I wonder if we should explain what it is. I think everyone listening to it knows, and even if you don't, you would have figured it out. But
you tell a story one word at a time. So you might have two or three players or four players up, and the players will take it in turns.
Indeed.
To say a word, and hopefully you get some kind of coherent story out of it.
Now, I used to hate this game when
really?
I started. I hated it. I didn't enjoy it at all because there was no way that I felt that I could get a laugh from the audience with a single word while there were up to three other people ruining my story for me. And I hated it for probably 6 or 7
years. So you're a control freak, Dan.
I was a bit of a control freak.
Was a control freak, ladies and gentlemen. You heard him make that assumption. I
got a certificate and everything. About 3 years ago, I started to... I realised the whole point of Word at a Time Story is to enjoy the discovery of what's coming out. When I started, I was so anxious about it going right that I was constantly trying to figure out where it was going. But it's a game where you cannot pre-plan, because if you do, it'll ruin the game.
Yeah.
So as long as you're just listening to what the other person's saying, you can just move straight into it.
And it's a good example of the rule of just saying what comes to your head. A lot of people will often think, what's a funny word? When the story is saying something like, I looked up and saw a... Some people might think, I've got to say something outrageously funny. So they might say a turtle, or and that can be fine under some situations, but I looked up and saw a plane crashing. The idea of just keeping it simple. I looked up and saw a light. I looked up and saw a man. I looked up and saw a street.
I find that if you're aiming for something that's sensible, that the audience will enjoy it more because it's going like no one's trying very hard. They go, wow, I can't believe they're making it look so simple. And it's like they're both thinking about the same thing. But as long as you know what's obvious, because in improv, I mean, if you know what's obvious, and that's not hard because it's obvious,
yeah,
you can both make a story without catching each other off guard, and you make a cohesive story, and the audience is like, I can't believe they did that.
And it also is a good idea that a lot of times in a word at a time story, you'll get offers coming up just by virtue of the fact that people are coming up with words. So early in a word at a time story, someone might say something like robber, and then you move on with the story, and then you find at the end, you go, and then I saw that, and you can go, oh, earlier there was mentioned a robber, I can bring that back in. So if you do that, if you're able to bring back an offer that was just sort of dropped earlier on by virtue of the fact of just repeating the word, the audience will think that you're this incredibly clever shelving machine because you've been able to incorporate all these different offers. So,
whereas one of the things I find with the beginners, and that is that even towards the end of a scene, they're constantly introducing new elements in a word at a time story.
Yes,
and it can be very, very painful.
Exactly. Anytime you do get one of those throw lines, like I saw a, here was the, in came the, and you've got to think of something. People often think, oh, I've got to think of something new, and really you don't. If you've already been given the offer of an elephant, you know, bring back the elephant. If you'd be given an offer about a burglar, bring back the burglar, and you don't need to overcomplicate it. Again, keep it simple. My cardinal rule for improv now, just keep it simple. Don't overcrowd yourself. Don't put too much load onto yourself as a performer, because the audience already think that you're pretty good in getting up and doing this thing where you don't have a script and you're just making it up. They're already giving you a certain level of respect by virtue of that fact. For the first couple of times they see the show anyway. If they're regulars, they might start going, hey, standards are really down tonight. But they give
hey,
you...
She's always doing that boob joke.
Exactly.
Flaunting herself.
That's my number one A material. So I think you can just not oversimplify yourself. And then as you get better as a performer and you start to learn what works, then you can start bringing in more stuff. But if you're starting out, you know, you don't have to conquer Everest straight away. And word at a time story is ever of improv. So, yes.
Although the one thing I've learned in a decade of doing improv is that if someone is messing up your story, then the best way of saving that is to pause whenever they say something completely surreal and get a look of terror on your face.
Oh, I see.
Because that way the audience at least can enjoy watching you suffer.
And that's a big part of it.
And you develop a relationship with the other person too, where if you're looking terrified, you're endowing them as doing it on purpose to give you a horrible time. Mm. And the audience is going to enjoy seeing that as well.
Another thing that I love about Word at a Time stories is no matter how many times you perform them and no matter how long you've been doing improv, you will always have a time where you'll just say two words. you know it's a Word at a Time story. You know you can only... instead of saying, I saw him climbing, you'll say, I saw him climb over. And you go, no, wait, that's two words. It happens to everyone, even though you know it's your brain is just automatically programmed to not say one word at a time.
My favourite instance of that was all the way back at the Hub Cafe. Greg was up on stage and he hadn't been doing it very long and he did two words and his eyes are bugged out of his head. And then he's made a little horizontal line with his fingers and mouthed the word hyphen. And I don't think the word that is a single hyphenated word. But they moved on.
Yes, exactly. And that's part of the enjoyment for the audience too, is they do like to see you fail.
And then occasionally you get groups of three where someone's a bit too eager and... instead of just going round robin,
oh, yes, it jumps.
Bounces back and forth.
Someone will just spring in with cemetery and the other person will be in the middle going, but what about my word? Yes, all the variations that can happen. But it's a good classic, it's a good standard, and it's a good one to demonstrate. I remember when Troy and I, and with Deborah Frances White from the Spontaneity Shop in the UK, was out here.
Name dropper.
I'm a name dropper. And we went up to Channel 9.
Troy Baker,
one of the gods. They wouldn't like me saying that. No, he's not. He's shit. Do you hear that, Troy? You're shit. He's very good. And Deborah is extraordinary as well. And we all went up to Channel 9 to do the program Hot Sauce. And we did some impro on that. And that was the game we actually used to sort of introduce the idea of
making something
up on the spot. Which was this is a surfboard. It is very nice. So, and it illustrated the point, and they cut to ads. So there you go.
I think that's the very first exposure I got to impro. I remember hearing on the radio, like probably 5 or 6 years before I even knew what impro was. I remember hearing people on the radio playing Word at a Time story, probably Kirsten and her friends just promoting stuff.
Which radio station?
I have no idea.
Triple Z?
Could have been Triple Z. But I've always found that Word at a Time story is just not a great radio game.
Well, it could be argued that no improv game is a great radio game.
Yeah, well, that's
game.
True.
Particularly a radio play.
Yes, radio play.
I would like to practice radio plays more, but we'll leave that discussion for another day.
And time. You've been listening to Natalie Bohensky. Nat's blog is at girlclumsy.com. There is no B in clumsy, despite what I keep trying to spell. And you've been listening to Dan Beeston. I've got a website at invisiblespiders.com, but there's currently nothing much on there.
Go visit, it's awesome.
For news about Impro in Brisbane, go to impromafia.com, possibly where you downloaded this podcast from, except for the fact that we're not going to be showing anyone. and hosting is provided by CivicNet Web Design. All right.
Just relax. Just relax, Dan. Would you like me to introduce it? Would it make you feel more at ease if I did the heavy lifting?
Yeah, you do that.
Okay.